Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode number 28 of the Misfit Faith podcast. I am your host, Jason Stellman. Our number is 949-354-2483. And if you don't remember that, then you can always remember it this way. It spells out the phrase, Why Eli Bite. W-H-Y-E-L-I-B-I-T-E. Who's Eli? Why is he biting us? We don't know, but that's not important. What's important is this number is notoriously difficult for me to remember, so that's one way to remember it. If you have a question, something you'd like me to address, give me a call. It goes straight to voicemail, and I will do my best to play it on the show and answer it as best I can. Hope everybody's having a good Father's Day. Today is Sunday, June 17th, Father's Day. It's a beautiful, sunny, hot day here in Seattle. It's about 80 degrees outside, and I am loving life. Now, a couple things before we begin. As you may remember, last week I made a big announcement, and that announcement was that I am lowering the threshold for membership in the Misfit Faith community. The Misfit Faith community is a private group on Facebook where we meet and do live chats. We're going through Brian McLaren's latest book, The Great Spiritual Migration, which I'll be talking about in just a moment. I also do live video presentations from my forthcoming book, Our Daily Dread, in the Misfit Faith community. It used to be the case that to be a member, you had to be a $25 a month patron. But in an effort to kind of broaden the reach of the group, and, you know, in response to some who said that it was a bit cost prohibitive, I lowered the price to 10 bucks. And so if you go to patreon.com, patreon.com/Jason Stellman, and become a $10 patron, then you can search for Misfit Faith Community on Facebook, and I will add you to the group. As you'll notice also, there are various rewards associated with all the different tiers. And so I think there's a $1, a $5, a $10, a $20. There are different rewards associated, and any sort of support that you can give is very, very much appreciated by me. So go to patreon.com/Jason Stellman, and if you're able to, become a patron. If you can do the 10 bucks, I'll add you to the Misfit Faith community, and you'll be able to have some access to me, to my work, and engage with other people who are spiritual vagabonds and misfits just like the rest of us. Another thing, and I mentioned this last week as well, but the video courses that I do in the Misfit Faith community, once we're finished, I package them as a single kind of bundled a la carte item that I make available for sale. And so if you're not really interested in joining the Misfit Faith community, but we go through a book that you think might be interesting, you can go to jasonstellman.com/shop and find those courses there. The only one up there right now at the moment is our video course through my book, Misfit Faith, which we finished up a few weeks ago. It's 7 videos. They're roughly an hour in length, and it's quite a lot of content, and the cost, I think, is 25 bucks. So not too bad, not too bad a deal at all. So jasonstellman.com/shop to find out more about that. Okay, enough of that. Let's move on. As I mentioned, I'm taking the members of the Misfit Faith community through Brian McLaren's most recent book, which is called The Great Spiritual Migration. And it's an excellent book. McLaren, we'll be hearing from him in just a moment, but he's a great guy, very, very knowledgeable, huge heart, a lot of compassion, and he really does, I think, speak with a kind of prophetic voice to the American church. And, you know, the chapter that we just went through, chapter 3, I believe it was all about the church. And it kind of reminded me of the series I did here on the Misfit Faith podcast called Faith Getting Woke. And I still want to do one final installment of that series. I'm waiting to be able to line up the interview that I'm trying to line up. But I did a series a little while ago called Faith Getting Woke, and the premise of that series was kind of that, you know, there are certain issues, hot button issues, that the church may need to rethink its stance on if it wants to be able to be taken seriously, if it wants to be able to speak meaningfully into the lives of people, post-Christian, non-church-going people in our increasingly postmodern and post-Christian culture. Now, what I want to talk about today sort of harkens back to that series. As I said, you know, there is a sense in which now that the conservative evangelical and the conservative Catholic communities have kind of pretty much completely bought into Trump's agenda, there's a sense in which there's little that can be done, it seems, to restore any moral or spiritual credibility for the church in the eyes of many people. You know, this is a man who brags about sexually assaulting women. This is a man who brags that he can gawk at them in their dressing rooms as they're changing into their bikinis, you know, at the beauty pageants that he owns. This is a man who mocks the disabled, who calls immigrants rapists and animals, who encourages mob violence against protesters. You remember that? Knock the crap out of them. I'll pay your legal fees. Don't worry about it. This is a guy who refers to African countries as shitholes, who says that Haitian immigrants all have AIDS. This is somebody who spends his time pretty much just insulting people, usually for being stupid or, if they're women, fat. This is the man that the vast majority of conservative Christians not only support. I mean, I think evangelicals, 80% of them who voted for him. But this is the man that the vast majority of conservative Christians not only support, but whom many believe is the fulfillment of prophecy and will usher in the second coming of Christ. And if you don't believe me, just listen to the audio from this trailer for an upcoming movie.
In 2006, 1 month from the day Mark Taylor retired from his post as a career firefighter, he was suddenly overcome by a Holy Spirit-guided supernatural vision of the future. This revelation, as the world would soon discover, was a message to the most powerful nation on earth.
The Spirit of God says, I have chosen this man, Donald Trump, for such a time as this.
It's time to embrace our glorious American destiny. Anything we can dream for our country, we can achieve for our country.
America will once again stand hand in hand with Israel, and the two shall be as one.
I want the Israeli people to know that the United States stands with Israel.
The dollar will be the strongest it has ever been in history of the United States and will once again be the currency by which all others are judged.
The economy is booming under this president.
We're up 254 points, 21,000 on the Dow.
They will say things about this man, the enemy, but it will not affect him.
Well, he's kind of a comic book figure. I mean, he's a show-off.
He's a sideshow who threatens to swallow the Republican Party.
He was attacked by other people who were running with him. His poll numbers would go up, theirs would go down, even to the point where they got kicked out of the race.
He would not be the commander-in-chief we need to keep our country safe.
Donald, adults learn not to interrupt you.
Yeah.
We are suspending our campaign.
I am suspending my campaign.
This next election will be a clean sweep for the man that I have chosen.
Donald Trump will never be elected president of the United States.
Still looks like Hillary's the next president.
On Election Day 2016, the world witnessed the impossible when in the final hour, the map turned red.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States.
Donald Trump is going to be our president.
Well, my crystal ball's been shattered into atoms here because I predicted the exact opposite of what happened.
But the election of 2016 was only the beginning. Mark Taylor, author of the Trump prophecies that foretold Donald Trump's unlikely victory and the stock market reaction that would follow, has something new to say about what is coming next. Something that will change the future of America and the world forever.
There's a bigger picture that the church is not seeing right now.
The Trump Prophecies, the astonishing true story of the man who saw tomorrow and what he says is coming next. Coming this 4th of July from Defender Publishing.
How in the hell did we get here? Now, in my opinion, Trump is not the real issue. he kind of embodies it, you know? He's like a big, sweaty, orange embodiment of the rotten core of American Christianity. But what is the issue if it's not him, then? What's lying at the back of all of this? What specter is lurking behind all this madness? I would suggest that it's this: fear. Fear is a powerful emotion, one that's strong enough when sufficiently stoked to get people to surrender their humanity the way many people have done. Fear will make us okay with the fact that 2,000 children have been separated from their parents and detained in camps and are being used as a kind of bargaining chip to get Congress to fund that damn wall. Fear will make us focus on the group of people that's just below us on the racial or socioeconomic ladder and make sure they don't take our jobs or benefit from our tax dollars. Fear is what huddles us together with our shotguns loaded in order to protect our stuff from those AIDS-riddled rapists from shithole countries. Fear is what drives us to applaud when our country starts severing ties with allies like Canada, Germany, and France, who all threaten to dethrone us from being, you know, king of the West. It's not about Trump. You know, even if MSNBC's wet dreams come true and Mueller wins and Trump goes away, the fear will still be there, waiting to be ignited by some new wannabe fascist dictator. Here's the irony in all of this. The most oft-repeated command in the Bible is fear not. If there were ever a community, then, that should be immune to having their fears stoked and used for hateful and racist purposes, if there were ever a people on whom attempts to get them to see every single unfamiliar thing as an imminent threat simply don't work, it should be the Bible-believing Christians in this country. But instead, there's perhaps no group of people more scared to death than them. It's like they don't even believe in the omnipotent, all-powerful God they act like they're worshiping every Sunday. I mean, it's almost as if their real God is power, and their true allegiances lie where that power is perceived to reside. Not in a church or on an altar or in a holy book, but at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, as I mentioned, I'm taking the Misfit Faith community through Brian McLaren's book, The Great Spiritual Migration. Now, I want to play for you a short clip of some thoughts that he gave. Keep in mind, last year, even though it's very prescient what he's talking about, but he gave these thoughts in 2017 concerning what it means and might look like to be a churchgoer in the era of Trump.
If you are a pastor, priest, or other Christian leader in the U.S., or if you are an active church member, the election of Donald Trump has changed your life and ministry, and not just a little, but a lot, and for the foreseeable future. In the last few weeks, I've heard from staff members who are being forbidden from posting on social media for fear it will inflame political tensions in their congregation. I've heard from pastors wondering how they'll feed their children if they speak out and are fired. I've spoken with pastors and church members who are so sickened by the politics of white Christian America that they just want to walk away from the whole thing. Whatever you're currently doing, celebrating Trump, denouncing him, or avoiding taking a side, seldom, if ever in your lifetime, have you faced such agonizing choices as a Christian. Christian communities have faced tough choices like these before. For example, in the U.S. during the eras of slavery and segregation, or in Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa, churches and church leaders witnessed the rise of harmful laws, policies, and social attitudes, and prayerfully pondered how to respond. Most of our ancestors traveled through their turbulent times on what I would call the highway of cooperation. What is the highway of cooperation? Let's say that the president never makes the long-awaited pivot. Let's say his character was accurately revealed in his statements about knocking the crap out of protesters. Let's say that soon there are mass deportation forces being deployed and that the government turns a blind eye as hate crimes proliferate against minorities. Let's say that the president continues to make statements with the same level of veracity as his claims about inauguration crowd size and voter fraud. Additionally, let's say Trump was right that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters wouldn't care. Can you see how the choice for cooperation, which might seem safe enough now, could become dangerous down the road? The highway of cooperation has two lanes. The fast lane could be called active collaboration. If you and your church take this lane, you will carefully avoid criticizing the Trump administration or offending its supporters. You will do so either because you are afraid or because you support some or all of the president's policies. You will bolster support for Trump by quoting verses like Romans 13, 1 and 2, submit to the governing authorities, or 1 Peter 2, 7, honor the king, as if they were the final word of your moral responsibility. If the Trump administration begins rounding up your undocumented neighbors or subjecting your gay or Muslim neighbors to insult, threat, or physical harm, you will give your tacit approval through careful silence, or you will voice your support and justify it using Bible verses. If you are asked to submit lists of names to the government, suspicious neighbors, non-compliant parishioners, or fellow clergy, you will comply, again, out of conviction or fear. At first, you may feel uncomfortable, but the more you bite your lip and swallow your concern, the more you'll be able to cooperate with just about anything. If church members come to you concerned about what's going on, disrespect for women and minorities, damage to creation, or harm to important public institutions like schools, the social safety net, or health programs, they may be worried about the way the president is alienating allies and goading enemies, or violating ethics and even the Constitution. You will tell them they must pray, submit, and trust. If they can't stand with you in your cooperation with the Trump administration, you will have no choice but to ask them to leave. The slow lane on this highway of cooperation could be called silent complicity. If this is your choice, you will double down on the personal aspects of faith and declare yourselves non-political. You'll downplay all social or public dimensions of the gospel and focus exclusively on personal sin, personal salvation, and personal fulfillment. You may convince yourself that you occupy the moral high ground because of your doctrinal purity or personal piety. You may not realize, however, that silence on public issues is profoundly political. Others will see how you have strained out gnats and swallowed a camel. At some point, you may come to realize that even though your congregation claims to be Protestant or Catholic, evangelical or charismatic, really, many of your members have become disciples of Fox News, extremist radio talk shows, and right-wing websites. Each Sunday, they'll want you to splash some holy water on their white Christian nationalist ideology. And as long as you do, they will show up and put money in your offering. Whether you travel the fast lane or slow, you may eventually feel so disgusted with yourself that you'll begin looking for an exit ramp from the highway of cooperation. You may even be developing your exit strategy right now.
Hey, Jason. Carl joined Trump as pastors a few times. And I called you a universalist, and you balked at it, and then you admitted you were one later. So, with that newfound revelation, I'm trying to figure out if there's... I guess because I was raised hellfire and brimstone, salvation was to be saved from hell. Help me see what it means when everyone's saved, like what faith matters then, because you're not being saved. It's almost as though you're not saved anymore, because everyone's saved. I don't know. See how I'm rambling? Help me figure out what it means. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thank you for that voicemail, man. I have no recollection of that previous exchange we had. It sounds like it may have been on Drunk Ex-Pastors, my other podcast, but I don't remember that. But I will say this much. You know, universalism, you know, the idea that everyone is saved... and I'm putting saved in sort of like imaginary quotes, I can see how it could be confusing if we couch the Christian faith in mostly legal forensic terms and ideas. You know, like God is a lawgiver primarily and a judge who imputes guilt to our account because Adam ate the apple, right? And then when we believe in Jesus, he acquits us in the courtroom of heaven based upon Jesus' own law-keeping that's imputed to us by faith alone. You know, if we're looking at the Christian faith in primarily those kinds of like legal forensic terms, then sure, it can sound sort of confusing to talk about everyone being saved. But if we take a more ontological approach, you know, and say that the faith is about participating in divinity by means of the indwelling spirit whom Paul says in Romans 5 sheds abroad or pours out the love of God in our hearts, right? Then if we couch it in those terms, more ontological and participatory terms rather than forensic and legal ones, then, you know, I think we can much more easily say that God is indeed at work in the lives of all people. And that work is evidenced by the love that we show to the other, to the stranger, to the foreigner, to our enemy. And plus, consider this. You know, what if the point of this whole thing, this whole project, the gospel, is not to escape the world, but instead to devote ourselves to it? You know, I think a lot of confusion about universalism generally is there because it's arising from a paradigm or from a standpoint according to which the whole goal is to die and make it to heaven, right? And so what's the point in anything if everybody dies and makes it to heaven, right? If the bar is so low that everybody who dies goes to heaven, you know, you could put it in terms of like justification by death, right? All you need to be justified is to die. If that is the goal, then it's no wonder that there's a lot of confusion over this idea that everyone is saved, right? But when we entertain the idea that the kingdom of God is an often subversive agenda of love and nonviolence that is directed toward this world that we live in now, and if that agenda will slowly permeate this world and spread, then it starts to make a little bit more sense, I think, this idea that universalism is true. I mean, I suppose you can have a completely forensic and escapist theology and still be universal, a universalist. But I think most people who would sort of identify as universalists are doing so based upon these other factors changing in their overall outlook. And so, you know, for me, I'm increasingly interested in and pursuing and mulling over this idea that, you know, at the end of the day, it's not about what happens at the end of the day. At the end of the day, it's not about escaping this world and making it to heaven, but instead it's about being in the world, throwing ourselves headlong into the deep end of this world, into the depths of the grit and the grime and the filth of this world, the messiness of it, and seeking to grow ourselves in grace, grow in the love of God, grow in the fruit of the Spirit, right? And that's what it's about. And if you can kind of wrap your mind around that, or maybe take your current set of glasses off and put on glasses that sort of lend this hue and shade to the world that you're observing, then maybe universalism, the idea of it, might make a little bit more sense to you. So anyway, feel free to call back, push back a bit if you want to, but I hope that helps a little bit. We're just about at the end of our time, but before I let you go, I do need a minute.
Now, it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
Now, I generally refuse to argue politics with people, especially online. I just find it a pretty fruitless waste of time, and I find that most people are kind of on the defensive from the get-go, and moreover, the forum for arguing about these very, very complex, nuanced issues is rarely going to be some social media platform like Twitter, right? I just don't find it profitable to argue politics online. But I've also noticed, and one of the reasons why I don't do this is because not only are people often defensive from the outset, in other words, they're trying to defend a position and digging their heels, you know, to defend a position, but also I find that a lot of times people are just in a completely different place in their overall evolution or consciousness or whatever you want to call it. You know, I recently read an article on the Huffington Post called "I Don't Know How to Explain to You That You Should Care About Other People." And it was actually quite good. And I want to quote just a couple of paragraphs from it to you now. The writer says, "I don't know how to convince someone how to experience the basic human emotion of empathy. I cannot have one more conversation with someone who's content to see millions of people suffer needlessly in exchange for a tax cut that statistically they'll never see. I cannot have political debates with these people. Our disagreement is not merely political, but a fundamental divide on what it means to live in a society, how to be a good person, and why any of that matters. I don't know what's changed, or indeed if anything has, and I don't have any easy answers, but I do know I'm done trying to convince these hordes of selfish, cruel people to look beyond themselves. Futility can't be good for my blood pressure, and the way things are going, I won't have health insurance for long." I do concur with these words and this frustration. You know, often when people debate, they think they're disagreeing about some specific issue. You know, border security, the minimum wage, whatever. When in fact what you have are two fundamentally different types of people simply being who they are at their core. You know, as I mentioned before, when one person is bound by fear and the other's fear has been cast out by love and they've developed the virtue of empathy and compassion, there's little that can bridge that gap. And at a certain point, all you can do is lament, maybe say a prayer, and maybe bang your head against the wall for a while.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, that is our show, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Again, our number is 949-354-2483, YELIBITE. If you want to be part of the Misfit Faith community, go to patreon.com/Jason Stelman and become a patron for $10. But even if that's not something you're interested in or able to do, any support at any level is very, very appreciated by me. And as I mentioned as well, the Misfit Faith video course, about 7 hours of video content, is for sale on my website, jasonstelman.com/shop. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. Bye-bye.